the forgotten men and women of the United States are forgotten no more. You're the great people. You're the great people. You work hard, you pay your taxes, you do all these things, and you were forgotten. They forgot about you. And you're the smartest people. You're the smartest people. You know, when they talk about the elite. The elite. Do you ever see the elite? They're not elite. You're the elite.
That was our President Donald Trump speaking at a rally in Ohio last week, during which he also warned that Democrats want open borders, if only, promised that we would soon be starting a Space Force branch of the military, and ranted semi-coherently, at best, about China's trade policies. More about that in a little bit. Good Monday, and welcome to the Reason Podcast. I'm your guest host, Peter Suderman, filling in for Matt Welch, who is crying quietly into an empty glass of wine somewhere. Today, I am joined by Reason Editor-in-Chief Catherine Mangu Warden, not one, but two special guests, Robbie Suave and Eric Bame. Everyone, say hello.
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 Okay, so I want to start riffing on our president here, talking about elites and their tweets. Last week, the New York Times hired Sarah Jong, a tech, law, and culture writer from The Verge, to be a member of the paper's editorial board, which basically means she's going to be writing unsigned editorials for the opinion page. Rather quickly, sites like The Daily Caller dug up a history of snarky, disparaging tweets about white people. For example, dumbass fucking white people marking up the internet with their opinions like dogs pissing on fire hydrants. That was from November 2014. Cancel white people hashtag around the same time. And it's kind of sick how much joy I get out of being cruel to old white men. Calls to fire her, many of them from people on Twitter, of course, followed. But the New York Times declined, saying in response, her journalism and the fact that she's a young Asian woman made her a subject of frequent online harassment. For a period of time, she responded to the harassment by imitating the rhetoric of her harassers. She now sees that this approach only served to feed the vitriol that we too often see on social media. She regrets it. The Times does not condone it. Robbie, I want to start with you. The controversy over Jong's tweets followed incidents in which movie director James Gunn got fired from Guardians of the Galaxy 3 for tasteless tweets joking about, among other things, pedophilia. Of course, Roseanne Barr's show getting canceled for tweets about Valerie Jarrett. Kevin Williamson getting fired earlier this year from The Atlantic for a tweet and remarks on a podcast. Uh-oh, everyone. You have written about most of these incidents, and generally you've been skeptical of the firings. So help us understand what's going on here. Why is this happening now? And if you can, try to outline a grand theory of firing by Twitter. Should anyone ever be fired for their tweets?
Right. So I have taken the position in, I think, every single one of these cases that the person should not have been fired because this would lead to a less interesting world if everyone is being held accountable for their worst moment. I mean, these that are creative, entertaining, writing people, many of them being fired for things they said on Twitter, sometimes a very long time ago under a kind of different environment where Twitter was kind of a different place. Sarah Jong had a very so her explanation is, I think, partly insufficient.
So why? What's insufficient about her explanation?
So she says this is satire, or that this is it's like she was copying harassment she was getting and tweeting back the same thing.
It is true that women on Twitter, Catherine, jump in here, get an awful lot of harassment.
Yes,
right?
Although
like, that's a real thing.
A friend of Reason, Kathy Young, has written, I think for us, that she thinks men are actually harassed just as much, if not more, than women on Twitter. But her tweets responding to, she wasn't responding to specific things in many cases. She wasn't quote tweeting. She wasn't replying. So if she was trying to engage in satire, she was not making it as obvious as she could have or should have. Also, I mean, I looked at a lot of these tweets, and again, I don't think we should be drumming up lynch mobs on people and doing this, but since it was in the news, I looked at a lot of them, and a lot of them seemed to be generated from probably just thoughts she had of her own or things in the news that I would be a little surprised if they were really specifically mirroring some form of harassment she was getting.
I mean, more Twitter likely, is just a kind of form of public muttering.
More likely she was signaling to people on the left who for whom racism against white people is impossible because racism must include an element of structural oppression and white people are not oppressed structurally. So for the left, white people cannot suffer racism. So she was signaling to the left that I am one of you. This is an easy way to do this is to tweet snarky and offensive things about white people. This is like a lefty initiation thing. That's my theory for what she was doing.
So, Catherine, I do want to ask you about online harassment. It's real. It happens a lot. First of all, is that something that you've sort of dealt with? And do you think that justifies, excuses, explains some of the stuff that she was tweeting? I mean, is it plausible or reasonable?
Yeah, so I sort of demographically want to identify with Sarah Jeong as a like weirdly colored haired elite writer interested in tech issues who is also a lady. Like, you know, on some level, I feel like, oh, okay, if anyone is positioned to understand why she might have felt the need to lash out, like theoretically, I could be. And I have to say, I don't quite understand why she felt the need to lash out in this way. Like, yeah, people are assholes online, for sure. And, you know, I get a certain percentage of gendered assholery in my timeline, which I think is, you know, I think Cathy Young makes some really good points about the overall numbers on these things. But there is a sort of special subset of harassment that women and people of color get that, you know, piles onto a long history of harassment. It's a legit point. The broader question, though, of like, does that mean you get to say awful stuff with no repercussions? I think the answer there is clearly no. I'm with Robbie. Like, this is not fireable. Like, the New York Times hired her just as The Atlantic hired Kevin Williamson, just as, you know, so many other of these incidents have played out, because she's actually a really good writer. Like, her professional output, which has been completely disregarded in this, as far as I can tell, is high quality. And she was a legit choice. People being sort of awful on Twitter to you, though, does not justify you being awful to an entire race of people categorically. And that's something that broadly, socially, we agree on.
They are going to be sort of hiding her in some ways behind the unsigned editorial, right? And the unsigned editorial is the sort of least stylistically interesting part of the op-ed page. And so in some ways, they're going to be taking away her opportunity to be unique individual.
I think her opinions will get somewhat homogenized, which, you know, ideally, I think the inputs for the unsigned editorial are various and in some cases even somewhat extreme, right? It is not good for a sort of totally centrist groupthink or left-center groupthink thing to happen inside this writer's room and then everything that comes out is just sort of mushy lefty gruel. Like, it's good if there's some crazy lefties in the room and also ideally some crazy righties. Ideally, some totally sane and reasonable libertarians as well.
But a concern that I have, and again, I don't think she should be fired for the tweets. But I would rather have her writing like a column that, you know, she could write a column, and I could be like, okay, well, this is wrong for these reasons, or it's right for these reasons. I might like some of the things she was saying. But rather, she's going to be in this kind of insidious behind the scenes, influencing a newspaper's voice at a time where the liberals are kind of rethinking their free speech and First Amendment commitments. The New York Times had that. That wasn't an editorial. That was a column, I think, about how the conservatives have weaponized the First Amendment and sort of signaling. I see these trends among left leaning people on college campuses and other places, social media. Concerns that the left is getting bad on free speech. And I'm very fearful that behind the scenes she would be someone influencing in that direction.
Performative wokeness on Twitter, though, we don't have any particular reason to think her views are going to substantially drag the Times in that direction, do we?
I'm only judging from her huge volume of tweets suggesting to me awful, awful opinions.
And it is kind of the volume that matters here, too, right? I mean, there are a lot of these. Peter read a few of them, but I mean, there were dozens upon dozens of these tweets that people dug up, which I don't know whether that changes your mind, Robbie, or how that affects the sort of assessment of whether someone should be fired. Well, like one bad tweet, all of us have had one bad tweet or many bad tweets even that we've deleted or reconsidered, or wish we could delete.
Days after the Rolling Stone gang rape story fell apart, she was still tweeting nothing we've discovered now fundamentally should have undermined Jackie's credibility, and that the only people raising serious questions about this are white men, even though there was in addition to me, there was Ash Gow and Kathy Young and Christina Hoff Sommers and Judith Shelovitz and tons of other people from a wide spectrum of voices were questioning this story, which turned out to be inaccurate. So that was one of a sea of bad opinions I saw from her on Twitter. Now, Twitter is not the measure of a person. Her output might be her book might be great. I don't know. But I don't think she should not be judged at all for these bad.
And probably also worth saying that like the New York Times standing up to the Twitter mob is significant because Kevin Williamson and James Gunn and whoever else, they've all been fired when the Twitter mob has come for them.
I do think we might have reached, I mean, there will probably be some backsliding, but I think it's possible that we have actually reached a tipping point and that this might be the point where we sort of say, you know, as publications at least, that we've developed some resistance to the Insta outrage for ancient tweets. Like, I think we're going to keep doing the outrage, but if I had to guess, I think those first few times the publications were like, whoa, we did not see this level of vitriol coming, and they reacted strongly to it. And now at least I think the vitriol will still happen, but people will see it coming and they'll be a little more kind of braced against it.
I hope that's right, but I hope it's also true that it's not just the Sarah Jongs of the world, but also the next conservative or libertarian or like radical,
yeah, well, they'll benefit
whatever
from that
might
less.
Be right.
So I'll defend the New York Times a little bit here and say that there were calls to fire Barry Weiss for some of the stuff that she's written and tweeted, and they didn't. And they didn't go after her at all. Eric, you mentioned that we all have had one bad tweet or perhaps a dozen or perhaps...
Are you about to ask him what his is so we can just get it over with?
My main question here is, what tweet are you going to get fired for? But also, I want to kind of bring a discussion that we've been having in the Reason office into this, which is about whether or not you should delete your old tweets. And so this, to me, is an important aspect of the Sarah Jong story, is that she's being called to account, called to be fired for old tweets, not for stuff that she did in the last 6 months, not for stuff certainly that she has done while on staff at the New York Times, but stuff that is quite a few years old. And same with James Gunn. So we've been having this debate in the Reason office a little bit where there have been two sides, basically one side saying you should delete all of your old tweets and that Twitter, it basically is an argument that Twitter should be experienced like a stream in the moment. And then another argument, another side is that you should never delete your tweets and that these are an important historical archive and record of your life and what you were thinking, whether it was cancel white people or man, this sandwich is really good. So how do you kind of see Twitter? How should we be thinking about this sort of as an archival format or as a of the moment comment format? What's the sort of where do you come down on this?
Twitter is an in the moment form. I mean, it has the archive function of it is interesting. The ability to go back and look at something that you tweeted 5 years ago or 10 years ago or that other people tweeted is interesting to a point, but it's not the ideal way. It's not the way Twitter is meant to be consumed. It's not the way it should be consumed. It very much is a running log of what you are thinking and consuming and commenting on in the moment. And just the way conversations, most conversations that you have, not this one, but most conversations are not recorded and played back for you 10 years later. Your tweets shouldn't be recorded and played back for you 10 years later. I have actually changed my thinking on this over the last 6 months or so because I used to be more towards the, no, we need the historical archive side of the argument. But
same.
I think I'm coming around. Yeah, very quickly.
Same. This Sarah Jong thing was what actually changed my mind. I was for keeping my tweets. Now they all have to go. I mean, I think it would be better if we lived in a world where people kept their tweets and you could look back on things you'd said a long time ago, or other people could look back on them, and it wouldn't be the measure of you as a human being. We would recognize that we have a capacity for growth and for intellectual and emotional development and maturity.
But no, you are what you tweet. That's it.
You are
right?
What you tweet.
And given the amount of time that certainly. Those of us on this podcast spend on Twitter. I was at having a dinner conversation with some other journalists over the weekend in which we realized that the entire conversation had simply been about stuff that people had tweeted. We had not talked about anything that night except, with the small exception of literally the food and drinks that we were consuming, it was, here is what somebody tweeted, here's what I think about that, do you think X, remember when this person tweeted, and so...
Every article I wrote last week was about something someone had tweeted, I think.
So I last week was completely off Twitter for the first time maybe ever.
Bless you. Can I live vicariously through that experience for just like a moment? Tell me what it was like.
It was just, I just heard the sound of the waves crashing on the beach and that my children's laughter.
Can we get the sound effect?
Mark's going to put that in for us later. Mark McDaniel, producer extraordinaire, insert beach sounds here. Okay, so I was worried about it, right? Because I am generally a cheerful multitasker. I am a person who is happy to kind of like consume a bunch of different data streams and also live my life. I do not think living on Twitter equals not living, as Peter's story demonstrates. You can have like a great convivial evening with friends and great drinks that also just is about Twitter. That said, I missed fucking nothing. Like, I missed a disaster of a week on Twitter in which everyone was their worst self. And I came back and I read for about an hour and caught up on every dumb thing that everyone on the whole internet had said. And I would have spent probably literally 40 hours on this otherwise during the course of that week.
It was a bad week.
It was a bad week for Twitter. I was off Twitter and that was a good decision by me. The only thing I did was come on Twitter very briefly to defend CJ Cirimella, reasons CJ Cirimella, from Sonny Bunch attempting to get him fired for a past bad tweet, which I didn't understand the context of because I had been offline. But Sonny tweeted at me, "Are you going to let this stand?" Because CJ had said something like, "Maybe you shouldn't sell heroin to children." So I jumped in to just be like, luckily I'm on vacation, I'm in a good mood, I'm going to let this pass, but this was a bad tweet and the wrong opinion.
So that is Reason's official policy on being fired for a tweet, is that you can tweet that we shouldn't sell heroin to children before you work for Reason.
Yes, but once you're on staff, you got to get with the program. No, my tweets have been on auto-destruct for a while now. And I stand by that. I think Twitter is an active conversation in real time. I think the medium has evolved. I think the same thing is true on Facebook, by the way, except that people started out with the sense of Facebook as a scrapbook, right? People as like a record. You know, I'm going to put my photos here and chronicle my events here. People definitely did not start out Twitter with that.
There's
sense.
That difference, and there's also the difference of the privacy settings that Facebook lets you have. And I know you can't put anything on Facebook, and it really expected to be private, sure, because it's on the internet. But there is sort of a two-way opt-in with Facebook, where if you want to shut people out or you want to keep things private, you want to just make it a scrapbook or a conversation between you and your college friends, you can do that. And I really use Facebook mostly that way, just in a very personal way. I don't broadcast a lot of stuff on Facebook. Twitter is a broadcast. I mean, it is you shouting into the void of the internet, and anyone who wants to see it can read it, it's like an on-off privacy option. And if you're going to turn your privacy on, you might as well just delete your Twitter because nobody can see it anyway.
So what you're saying is delete your account?
Yeah, delete your account, yeah.
Speaking of accounts that should be deleted for bad tweets, our president, Donald Trump, has been tweeting about trade again. Over the weekend, he declared that we could pay off our national debt by instituting tariffs. Our $21 trillion debt that has been accumulated, much of it by the Obama administration, Trump tweeted, because of tariffs, we will be able to start paying down large amounts of the debt. This follows on Friday. The Chinese government threatened to impose tariffs on $60 billion in U.S. goods if the White House does not halt pending penalties on Chinese imports. The Chinese Commerce Ministry said in a statement it could add duties of 5, 10, 25% on something like 5,200 types of U.S. imports, and warned that it could also adopt additional countermeasures at any time. Basically, the trade war is on. China said it was responding to Trump's threat Wednesday to raise a proposed tariff on $200 billion worth of Chinese goods from 10 to 25%. Trump's threat, according to presidential advisors, was supposed to scare China into submission, but instead it appears to have made China more aggressive. Eric, you've written extensively about Trump's trade policies. Help us understand the dynamic here. Is this just a negotiation that is happening through tariffs and threats of tariffs?
And is there a win here in the future? After all, Trump did get that great deal with the EU.
That's the sound of me knocking my head against the desk, because that's how stupid this whole thing has been. Let's start with the most recent thing, what he tweeted this weekend, that we can pay down our national debt, our $21 trillion,
that's
with a T.
That's a big debt.
That's a big
debt.
We've
got a deficit. There's debt.
It's all
there's
the debt.
There's trade deficit.
It is a great national debt.
China's going to pay it for us.
Yeah.
Right?
The best estimate that we have for how much revenue the tariffs are going to generate this year is $21 billion. Now, that's nothing to sneeze at. That's a lot of money, but that's money, ultimately, we should remind everybody, tariffs are taxes. The people who pay for tariffs are not the other countries. It's American businesses and American consumers that are consuming imported goods that we bring here from other countries that are then artificially inflated in price because of the tariffs. So it's Americans that are paying that $21 billion. $21 billion. Do the math, Robbie, for me, is...
Oh, you really turned to the wrong reason, Stabber, at this moment of need.
Don't say the sentence, do the math, Robbie.
I got pen and paper.
That is 0.1% of the national debt. That is what that would represent. But that $21 billion, Trump has already pledged to spend $12 billion to spend that on farmers that have been hurt by tariffs. So that's more than half your tariff revenue right there gone. If other industries get that same treatment, and already there's talk about doing similar bailouts for other industries that are hurt by tariffs, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce puts that tab somewhere around the high 30s, nearly $40 billion. So you're in the red already. You've already spent more money on tariffs than they're bringing in to begin with. You're not paying down the national debt. This is the most insane thing. Trump continues to sort of grasp about for new justifications for these tariffs. They were originally about national security. Technically, legally, this is a national security matter, these steel and aluminum tariffs, but
how Trump can do these unilaterally without Congress. That's the justification, right? That's the legal requirement for Trump to be
under
able to
the Trade Expansion Act of 1962. The president is allowed to do unilateral tariffs for national security reasons. So technically, officially, legally, this is all about national security, but Trump continues to go off course on this, obviously, as he does with everything else. He's claimed that the tariffs are there to negotiate to create leverage, to renegotiate our trade deals with other countries, including China and the EU. He's blamed Canada for the tariffs, saying that it's Canada's high tariffs on American dairy products. That it's just insane that that's what the tariffs are for, that they're punishing Canada somehow. He continues to grasp about because the actual, whether you're talking intellectually or economically, the rationale for tariffs continues to just sort of collapse around the Trump administration. So he is, I think, continually grasping around for like a new politically motivated justification for tariffs.
But Trump says the tariffs are working big time. Catherine, I want to ask you about this. This is a policy discussion in a lot of ways. At the same time, it is hard to avoid psychoanalysis. Why does Trump think about trade policy in such zero-sum terms?
I think there are three parts to that. Part the first, Trump continues to be confused about the distinction between trade deficits and budget deficits. This is, I genuinely believe, a thing that is not clear in his mind. So when he says, we're using all this money on the trade deficits, he thinks that that money would go into the pile of money that is the money that Congress can spend on things, like or something. I don't know. But that is a really, really, really important distinction. Trade deficits are a sort of term of art where we contrast the amount of stuff that we buy with the amount of stuff that we sell to other countries, to put it very, very simply. And that number is either a net positive or a net negative. That does not tell us about a transfer of money anywhere in the system.
And none of that money is government money either. That's
none
all
of that money.
This
is money that
exchange.
Exists in the private sector or in the market. And then there are budget deficits, which is where Congress spends money it doesn't have. Right. So just to be clear, those are different things. Part the second is that I think he wants us to have money. Like the accumulation of money is the thing that matters a lot to Donald Trump. And so what's wrong with that?
Do you not want us to have money?
I also want to have the money. But the thing about it is money is only good for buying things. And the way that we buy things is that someone makes the things and then we give them our money for the things. And sometimes the people who make the things are foreigners, and that's okay because we give them our money, but they give us the things. And
I actually want to add another Trump quote from one of his speeches about a week ago. If we didn't trade, we'd save a hell of a lot of money.
Right. This is, and we would, right? Like Scott Linsacombe actually said this, I think, in the New York Times or something recently. He said, it's true. We would have a large pile of money, but we would not have anything else. We would not have the objects that we use every day, right? So it's true, in some sense, we would save a lot of money, but money is not a good unto itself.
But then you'd be able to be like Scrooge McDuck and go swimming.
That's right. That's what Scott, Scott said. He said, unless your goal is a Scrooge McDuck-style swimming pool full of cash, in which case, congratulations, we've done it.
The third point, I think, though, is that Trump is not actually concerned with the underlying economics, right? He wants to say things that appeal, and that was the quote from the top of the show. He wants to say things that appeal to his voter base. And for them, you know, what matters is this particular sort of well-trod rhetorical path where the jobs are here and the money is here because we are making America great again.
Robbie, I want to bring you in here a little bit. Don't worry, there won't be any math. Even people who are nominally defenders of Trump on the right often will criticize his trade policies while talking about all of the other things he does that they like. But Gorsuch, but Kavanaugh, but deregulation and tax cuts. So let's say, as many people perhaps on this podcast I think do, that you believe that Trump has done some good things and some bad things. How do you go about balancing those judgments, specifically with regard to his trade policies, but really kind of weighing just on a policy basis? Forget all of the kind of tweeting nonsense. How do you go about weighing the different Trump policies and what he's done well and what he's done really not so well?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, this is a pretty consequential bad thing, right? The trade plus the, I mean, even his other category of policies that I would say are very bad. Immigration is, to some degree, he's been continuing bad. I mean, I think he's made them worse, but some of the whole locking up families and all of that was started under the previous administration.
He's also been thwarted in the immigration stuff right. at a variety of turns in right. a way that is less true of trade.
But trade is something that his policies are very bad. They are 100% out of step with any other Republican or even probably most Democrats who would have occupied this same space. He is much more protectionist, much worse from a libertarian standpoint, and the immigration. You know, right? He is sometimes he's just governing like a normal Republican in terms of you know some regulation, some bureaucratic EPA type stuff. In other ways, he is not like a typical Republican in ways that could be good with some of the attempts, clumsy though they were, to initiate dialogues with North Korea. Things like that, the less full-throated, hawkish neoconservatism that I despise and was really looking for a change, of course, from Republican leadership. So it's such a mixed bag, but the two things that seem to matter to Trump most, immigration and trade wars, he is really bad by libertarian standards and even just by normal Republican standards.
And so one of my concerns with this is that the bad trade policies enable additional worse policies. And Eric, I know you were tweeting about a New York Times story that just ran in the last day or so, basically pointing out that the steel industry has successfully squashed requests to use foreign steel by basically saying, well, these products are available in the United States. And so it is enabling a kind of crony capitalism. They, of course, have some direct shady connections to the administration, in particular to Trump's very anti-trade economic advisor, Peter Navarro. Can you just sort of talk about the cascading effect, the way that these bad trade policies then end up enabling additional worse policies?
These trade policies require big government to enforce them. That's what tariffs are, right? And they just sort of create an entry point for more government and for more cronyism in exactly the way the New York Times has looked at. And I don't think this has really gotten enough scrutiny yet, even though it has been in the New York Times, is this process for giving out these tariff exemptions that the Commerce Department is doing. So you have to go back. Trump instituted these tariffs on steel and aluminum. And then there's a process, a bureaucratic process for companies to go to the Commerce Department and say, we shouldn't have to pay this tariff because we literally cannot get product XYZ that we need to make component ABC in this country. We have to import the steel to make that product. And then the Commerce Department, in a process that is completely obfuscated from public oversight, there is no transparency, there is no, as some CEOs have told the House Ways and Means Committee in a hearing last week, there's really no communication after that application is filed. There's a 30-day comment period, and then the Commerce Department does whatever mental jujitsu they do, and then they come out with an answer that says either yes, you get the exemption, or no, you don't. And if you don't get that exemption, that's potentially a multi-million dollar hit to the business's bottom line. So this is a high stakes process where there is literally no accountability. There is no due process. There's no way to appeal that decision that the Commerce Department makes. And there's also no publicly listed criteria for how the Commerce Department is making these decisions. So when you have that sort of process, you can see how U.S. Steel, which has a very intense interest in limiting the amount of foreign steel that comes into the country, they can intervene in that process during the 30-day comment period. They often do. And so far, as the New York Times found, so far in every tariff exemption application that either U.S. Steel or Nucor, which is another big domestic steel producer, every time that they have intervened and said, no, do not grant this exemption, the Commerce Department has done exactly what they have asked and not granted that exemption.
I do want to say that I think when this does get covered, because I think it will get covered, like this is a growing story, like the croniest elements of it, but it's going to be covered as Trump is awful, right? It's going to be covered as like, well, look at the connections between his family and the industry and whatever. And I actually think that's the wrong way to cover it. Like Trump is a little more awful on balance than previous presidents, you know, on the particular kind of emoluments and cronyism
style, stuff. Right?
But I mean, the thing that is far more central here is just it's a standard cronyist dynamic where a very powerful player willing to invest in aggressive lobbying presence can get its wishes implemented into law. And it's not about Donald Trump being crappy. It's about government being crappy.
It's very much the process. And we can even sort of take it to another level. The meta level here is to say that, look, there have been over 20,000 tariff exemption applications filed so far with the Commerce Department from nearly 2,000 different businesses in the country. But the businesses that are filing those exemptions have some sort of a built-in advantage over many businesses that don't. I mean, that it requires time and resources. It requires hiring probably an attorney or taking one of your senior staff off of something else they could be doing to deal with the Commerce Department's bureaucratic process and to file this application, which is something that many small businesses can't do. Or many businesses don't have much of a chance of making that argument and winning the appeal anyway, or winning the application appeal anyway. So they're not even going to try. So it is, I mean, there's sort of layers of cronyism here where this whole process is set up. And again, no transparency, no due process whatsoever here. Just, yeah, it really is a very intensely cronyist process. And it does sort of throw all of the problems that the tariffs have created into stark relief.
And it's pure deadweight loss. Right, like all 100%. Of this back and forth, all of this, who gets the exemption, who doesn't.
Which is, for those who did not take economics classes,
It sounds bad. It's actually a great, like, deadweight loss is like, that's my wrestler name later, like, or something. But like,
that's my supervillain power.
Deadweight loss. Yeah. It's just, so this is, you know, there are no gains from any of these interactions. These are just, you know, this is just the part of the transaction where if none of it had happened, both parties would benefit more. And instead, we're basically burning money on a fire while lobbyists take, and that this really is zero sum, right? This is the place where zero sum is real in some sense, is like there's going to be someone who benefits and someone who loses, and they're fighting over that rather than everybody fighting to, you know, get benefits.
And you've got the same sort of thing with the $12 billion that he says he's going to send to farmers through this New Deal crop insurance program that we haven't used in decades, but we're going to put $12 billion in there and send it to farmers who would have just sold their crops and made that money on their own anyway without us having to subsidize them for the losses that they have because of our policies. So it is, you don't, like, even if that works the way it's supposed to work, all you've done is get them back to where they were before you put the tariffs in place. Nobody's winning. It's just a question of how bad you lose.
And Veronique Durugy is somewhere quietly crying because her whole shtick about how you never get rid of a crop support or agriculture subsidy program is proving so tragically true right now.
All of this reminds me of my favorite line from the Hayek rap. If everyone was staffed in the army and fleet, we'd have full employment and nothing to eat.
Wow.
So bad big government.
Wow.
Leads to more bad big government. That has absolutely no connection to our next topic.
Medicare for all would cost how much? A new study estimates that Bernie Sanders' single-payer plan would cost $32 trillion, that's trillion with a T, in additional government spending over a decade. And that's under some rather generous assumptions. The study was authored by Charles Blahaus, a scholar at the Libertarian Mercatus Center, where we have a number of friends, and a former Medicare trustee. Blahaus is a former Medicare trustee, and its conclusions were broadly in line with other studies that have found single-payer would cost basically that amount. But liberals jumped on this study, saying that what it proved is that Medicare for all would actually cost less than the current partially private system that we have now. Eric, again, I want to start with you since you've written about this quite a bit. What's going on here? Did a libertarian think tank really make the case for Medicare for all?
Kinda. There's two ways to read this study, right? And that conclusion that liberals and progressive, the Vox crowd, have jumped on is kind of there. But what that takes into account is it says, look, what we're going to do is we're going to spend $32 trillion over the next 10 years. What this study says is $32 trillion over the next 10 years. That would basically require doubling current tax revenues. So take all the tax money you pay to the federal government right now, double it, add a little more on top, and then you get to what you would need for a single payer system.
Right. It's cheaper overall, but we'd be spending all of that money.
Spending all of that through the government. Right. But what that's going to replace is it's going to replace your healthcare premiums, your co-pays, all the other things you pay out of pocket. So in aggregate, if you add it up for the whole country, we would, this study suggests, and it's based on a lot of assumptions that you could really, you know, nitpick with on exactly how much cost savings you would get out of a government system. And we can get into all that. But what it ultimately says is that over the course of 10 years, we would pay less in just taxes than we would currently in taxes plus medical expenses. But that's $32 trillion in taxes that you're giving the government that then the government is going to make decisions on how to spend. And I think that the real point of the study here is that this is a massive tax increase. It would be a massive transfer of wealth from the private sector into the government. And it would also do away with our current system is an absolute mess. Peter, you can talk more about this. But as bad as our current system is, there is at least some level of consumer direction of health spending. It's very difficult oftentimes to make your own decisions about where to spend your health dollars. But there's at least some of that, which there wouldn't be in a government system. You would pay your taxes and you would get the health care you're given.
So as with trade, this seems to be one of those policy areas where we have a lot of government intervention already, and people are proposing additional government intervention in order to solve the problems that current government interventions have caused. But I also think that there's a sort of partisan political angle here. Catherine, I wrote a piece last week arguing that Medicare for All is surging in popularity right now, in part because Republicans have made it pretty clear with the tax bill, with the spending bill, with the $12 billion in aid to farmers hurt by the trade war, with the possibility that we will have tax cuts 2.0. They have made it very clear, I think, that they just don't care about debt and deficits. We saw this also during the George W. Bush administration, so it's not specific to Trump. And I think that has given Democrats a kind of a permission slip where they will say, okay, you guys don't care. Why should we even pretend to either? So I want to kind of get your sense. What do you think of that? Why is single payer so hot in 2018? Is it just hypocritical Republicans who are being bad on debt and Democrats responding accordingly?
So I think there's a chance here that we will see this will just be Medicare Part D on steroids. Like, I think the only thing...
Medicare Part D, brought to you by Republicans.
Exactly. So the only thing that is keeping, I think, a Medicare for All, like a true robust Medicare for All bill from being written and actually passing, is that this Congress and president are so dysfunctional, they might not be able to do things. But...
Wait, you think that they would... that this would happen under Republicans?
This is my dark theory. This is the darkest timeline theory.
I mean, Republicans are running pretty hard against the sort of Ocasio-Cortez-style Democratic socialism.
Go with me on this, right? So Republicans also ran pretty hard against entitlements and for entitlement reform in previous administrations, including the Bush administration, which gave us the biggest new medical entitlement before Obamacare,
And one of the big plans there was to reform Social Security, and they started the process and then immediately bailed on it.
So I don't think it will be called Medicare for All if it happens under Trump and with a Republican or heavily Republican Congress. But I think we could easily move way in this direction because, as you say, they don't care about spending, and because, like, Republicans just they don't have an alternative right now, as you've written many, many times for us and in the New York Times. The sort of repeal and replace was like, oh, let's actually not repeal and we don't have a plan for replacement, so never mind. I could easily imagine a world in which we walk right into a thing that looks almost exactly like Medicare for All under Republicans, and it will be precisely because Republicans have stopped even pretending to care about spending.
And Donald Trump is a former single-payer supporter who talked about how great single-payer is on the campaign trail while running as a Republican.
And if the Democrats take Congress and they package this as Trump Care for All, it immediately gets signed. There's not even, he would switch in an hour.
Yeah.
I don't think the
Democrats would oppose it if Trump did it.
Yeah. If it was literally the Medicare for All plan, but called Trump Care, they would like fight to the death.
Yeah.
I don't think so. I think you would have some grumpy Democrats who would be like, really, this isn't Trump Care. And that just shows you how awful our president is. But if Donald Trump were like, we're doing $32 trillion single payer, let's make it happen, I think that Democratic leadership in Congress would be like, all right, let's do it.
Yeah. Am I being too cynical? Like, you tell me. I think this is not a super likely outcome, but I don't think it's an impossible one. And I think that, you know, the whole kind of Romney Care, Obamacare switch a move progression, and the fact that Medicare Part D did happen under Republicans says like there's a certain amount of precedent for something like this going down.
I think the Republicans and Trump and leadership will continue to offer basically nothing that is satisfactory on any level while Democrats continue to push Medicare for All and it becomes increasingly popular with young people. Yay, socialism, it's all about that now. And eventually maybe comes to pass if Democrats retake control of the government, which might never happen, but could in 10 years.
We could just be in the normalization phase of Medicare for All, not in the crafting and passage phase.
So I remain a single-payer skeptic, and the reason why is because when states, even quite liberal states, California, Bernie Sanders' home state of Vermont, have looked at doing this, what they've found is that the tax hikes would be too large even for the bluest of blue states. And so I don't think that we are going to get single-payer, at least not in the short term. I think what we're going to get is calls for single-payer, and they're going to talk, but they're not going to talk about single payer. They're going to talk about Medicare for All. And if you've seen some of the interviews, BuzzFeed in particular did a really nice report on this, basically talked to Democratic voters who were like, well, Medicare for All just means more. It doesn't mean a specific thing. It doesn't mean single payer. And now some Democratic strategists are embracing that idea of of Medicare for All, of just meaning a little more government intervention.
Kind of like socialism, right, just means more redistribution.
Yeah. And people think so. Yeah.
I think that what we're going to end up with is a public option, which is a government-run health insurance alternative that coexists within the marketplace. And the reason why is because the deficit politics still end up looking very good. On paper, it scores as a deficit reduction from the Congressional Budget Office. It doesn't look like a thing that you need to pass giant tax hikes in order to pay for.
And just to bring this down from wonkies a little bit, that would mean essentially Medicare for all who want it. It would be, you would expand eligibility to everybody, not have the age limits on it. And if you wanted to be in that, you could, but you could still buy private insurance.
I feel like maybe using the phrase expand eligibility was not de-wonkifying that conversation
very much. You'd get rid of the age requirements.
It would, depending on the plan, it would basically allow anyone in the country to buy into a government-run healthcare plan. There would still be some premiums. You would still have to pay some amount for it. There might be some restrictions, such as if you get such and such employer plans, you don't have the option to buy in. But it would be a government-run health insurance plan that basically anyone would be able to buy into, and it would look something like Medicare or Medicaid. It's not clear, depending on how much money, sort of how robust they wanted to make the coverage. In any case, this has been proposed as a backdoor plan to get to single payer because, of course, the government will be competing, but not exactly competing on the same terms that a private company that a private insurer ends up working on. And so the more people that move into a government-run plan, the closer you end up to a fully government-run system. And so over time, the idea is that it would just kind of transition people by their own choice and solve most of the transition
problems. And that gets you out of the...
What people will say is, and we'll do the premium support, or we'll support the cost of such a plan by taxing the rich, but what we will actually do is fund it with debt.
We fund everything.
Like I said, on paper, it does score as a deficit reducer.
So this is the other argument, is that you increasingly see liberals saying, well, because the U.S. prints its own money, deficits don't matter nearly as much as we thought. And basically, we shouldn't worry about them. We should worry about what we want to do.
And I think that these arguments are going to sort of coalesce and coincide with Republicans through their actions, making the case that they don't care about deficits either. And that is, like I said, giving Democrats permission, encouraging them, I think, in some ways.
No one in Washington cares about deficits. But the other thing this does is it also short circuits the best argument against this politically would be for conservatives and Republicans in Congress, even though they don't actually care about the debt, to go to their voters and say, hey, Democrats are going to, you know, wreck the economy and drive up the debt if you vote for this single payer system. It short circuits that argument. In polling that's been done, support for single payer is fairly high, but it drops significantly once you ask the second question, which is, here's how much it's going to cost. Once you add that detail, support for it drops significantly. But if you present it just as an option, that kind of short circuits that political argument against it, and it allows everyone to just pretend like the debt doesn't matter. And that's where all our parties want to be right now.
So do we all disagree we're doomed?
Yes.
Speaking of doom, 3D printed guns.
Wow.
Was not being doomed even an option?
not with Cody Wilson in the mix. So let's talk a little bit about 3D printed guns. Cody Wilson, Defense Distributed. Last month, Wilson, the founder of Defense Distributed, which circulates plans to help home gun makers, won permission from the government to post files with plans for 3D printed weapons. In response, the New Jersey Attorney General issued a legal threat saying that plans to allow anyone with a 3D printer to download a code and create a fully operational gun directly threatens the public safety of New Jersey's residents. Basically, we're doomed. Posting this material online is no different than driving to New Jersey and handing out hard copy files on any street corner. This isn't just liberals, though. President Trump also expressed concern, where else, on Twitter, about the files, and in response to the outcry, Defense Distributed has suspended plans to release new files. Now, there's also, to be clear, some confusion about the product that Defense Distributed is offering and has offered. It's legal, for one thing, for most people to make guns at home. Lawmakers and journalists have also sometimes not distinguished between 3D printed plastic guns that, like, you make out of a printer and like you get plans for online, and Wilson's Ghost Gunner milling machines, which make untraceable lowers for AR-15 rifles. The AR-15 rifle is basically a kit rifle that you can build at home using different off-the-shelf pieces and that you can modify on your own. And so he has a machine that allows you to make the bottom part of it, basically sort of, you almost think of the handle, for those of you who may not be gun nuts. Probably not many on listening to this podcast, but Catherine, on a scale of global warming to DDT to trans people in bathrooms, how doomed are we?
Again, with the segues, the gun situation is, the doom level has not escalated at all based on what happened with Defense Distributed this last week. The doom level is precisely where it was before. And I say that as someone who's been playing a lot of strategy board games where the escalation of doom levels is something that's really been on my mind. Keeping those levels stable is important. And we have done that here. You know, this is something that Reason's Brian Doherty has said to anyone who will listen for many, many years. It is already illegal and has been since 1988 to make a gun that is not detectable by walking through a metal detector. That is a thing that people don't seem to know. And that the very specific subset of these all plastic firearms theoretically fall into. This is nothing like the whole subset, though, of homemade guns. Of course, in our July issue, the Burn After Reading issue, we printed instructions for how to make a gun at home. This was based on parts you can buy off the internet. It was a metal gun. And we also published a video, and also a video about how we couldn't release our video on YouTube.
Where did we publish that video?
Pornhub, friends. Go check it out. And the idea...
Reason editor says go to Pornhub.
Yeah, well, that's like, you know, dog bites, man. Which I think that's on Pornhub too, probably. So there's, you know, there's this weird hysteria as if suddenly each time there's a new court decision or something comes down with respect to Defense Distributed that this is the end of peace in New Jersey or whatever. And this is never true. And most importantly, and this is something that Brian Doherty also always says, this is about speech. This is not about guns. This is about speech. And publishing a description of a thing that a person could do, publishing words, that should be legal. That should be legal. It's protected under the First Amendment. It should be legal. This is not fire in a crowded theater. It is not one of the very, 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 very narrow exceptions that we make. It's speech.
Going back to how bad last week was, the speed with which this 3D printed gun outrage, or not really outrage, but scaremongering just took off in the media last week was truly terrifying. It gave me whiplash. I was away on Monday and Tuesday, and I would check my Twitter feed every so often, and it was like the escalation of doom seemed like it was almost an hourly thing. It was like, some people might have 3D guns. Everyone might have 3D guns. We might all already be dead because of shootings from 3D guns. Like,
I have already shot myself with a 3D gun in the hours following this settlement. Decision. Yeah, I mean, people got immediately hysterical, and it's because people don't understand. People lack the technical knowledge and also lack an understanding of the underlying legal principles, neither of which are hard to get if you go looking, but people are so averse, and they think of this as such a terrifying, edgy thing, when in fact, its very edginess is one reason it's not terrifying. Most people just aren't going
to
do it.
Robbie, you've written so much about free speech. I sort of want you to help us contextualize this. Again, like Catherine said, part of what is very interesting about this is that Cody Wilson makes the argument that this is less about the Second Amendment and much more about the First Amendment, that it's about free speech much more than it's about gun rights, although, of course, the two are related and intertwined here. Is this part of a kind of larger breakdown in defense of free speech on the left? Because, you know, this is, again, I think something that is one of the big themes in your work. And this is mostly liberals who are objecting to this. Should you be able to post 3D gun plans and cancel white people hashtag on Twitter, I think, is my question.
Yeah, of course you should. And it is absolutely a speech issue primarily rather than a gun issue. It cannot and should not and is not illegal or to just post information on how to do something. It doesn't cross into sort of unprotected speech unless you're like literally instructing people to imminently commit a crime, which is where
see this as a kind of a fundamental misunderstanding, yeah, of what speech protects? And do you see any sort of a kind of partisan divide here? Because again, this is coming almost the calls for Wilson to not put this up, for him to be legally restricted, are coming almost entirely from the left, with the exception of Donald Trump himself.
Frankly, it reminds me, or it's similar to the kind of ACLU's semi-retreat on defending speech in context with guns, right? That we saw from after Charlottesville last year. They said, we're not going to defend protesters who plan to protest to carry guns when they protest. We're not going to defend people's First Amendment rights if they're trying to exercise them simultaneously with their Second Amendment rights.
You get one right at a time.
One right at a time.
What the Bill of Rights was like. It was a Bill of Rights. Like, you have you get to pick which one.
You could do them in series, but not in parallel.
which previously, and that was different than their previous stance, was just like, we're not really into the Second Amendment, whatever. We're just going to kind of ignore that one exists. But now here they were saying that, I mean, this is a step beyond that, right? They're saying, we're also not interested in defending your First Amendment rights if you're engaged in a Second Amendment protected activity. And so we've seen other kind of instances from the ACLU over the last year of cases where I'm a little sketchy about where they stand on free speech. I mean, just on Friday, I wrote something for Reason about a tweet from the ACLU's Twitter account that was quickly deleted.
Because that's all we write about.
Right. As I said, that's the only thing I did last week. But they tweeted a story about France banning catcalling, with adding the caption, your turn, America, like calling on America,
move, America.
Your move, America, calling on America to take this bold progressive action. And I'm sure this is just some stray social media person, but to this person to go through a job interview at the ACLU and not understand their historic ironclad commitment to free speech, I think actually maybe does say something, that the organization is just positing itself as a generic progressive organization, which means in some cases its commitments will overlap with its existing civil liberties ways of thinking. But when they don't, the kind of progressive worldview is going to win and free speech will not.
I also want to say that this brings us full circle because the problem with the defense distributed stuff is that it's prior restraint, right? So it's not just a question of dealing with the consequences of speech after the speech has been spoken. It's prohibiting publication in advance, which is something that, of course, you know, media organizations have fought for years and years, famously. And it's done on the premise of ITAR, which is the agreement that restricts trade in weapons, right? It's the idea that that words can be arms in this case. Which brings us back to the garbage fact that everything is justified on the basis of national security, even when it's very clearly not.
All right. And with that, let's go to our final segment here. We're going to talk about what we've been reading, watching, consuming. Eric, let's start with you. What do you have for us this week?
I've actually been really busy the last couple of weekends and haven't had a chance to do a lot of reading, but I did at the beach a few weeks back put away Kitchen Confidential, which I had never read. And it was, of course, this is Anthony Bourdain's, I believe it was his first book. And I'd never read it. Shortly after he died, our colleague Mike Riggs wrote a really fantastic obituary for Bourdain and quoted a bit from Kitchen Confidential. So I went and picked that up. And it's an excellent read. If you haven't had a chance to read it, it is very much like one of his television shows, but about his own life, in the sense that his voice and his narration is so distinctive. In like, even when you're reading it, it sounds like you're watching his show on CNN. Like, you hear him talking in your head, and so it's really remarkable too that he has that sort of voice, even from, well, this was written, you know, well before he was a TV personality, but that sort of established narrative voice is there, and just sort of a fascinating thing. Don't ever order seafood on Mondays in restaurants is probably the best lesson in the book.
He is an immensely talented writer. It's actually frustrating how good he is, given that he really didn't start writing until his late 40s. If you don't have the patience or time to read that whole book, I definitely recommend the New Yorker essay that he wrote, I believe, in the late 1990s, that got him that book deal. It will take you 15 minutes to read, and it's just wonderful. Robbie, you're up next.
My Sunday night TV schedule for the summer has been Next Food Network Star, which just concluded. They crowned a champion. It's a great show, showing you how the sort of food celebrity is manufactured very deliberately. But what I want to talk about is the show I watch after that is The Affair, which is now in it's a Showtime show, now in its fourth season, about four people, two couples whose lives are destroyed by this disastrous affair. It's now like years after that happened, but last night was like the best episode the series has ever had, featuring a road trip of the two men who are now both divorced from the woman of the eponymous affair woman.
So wasn't there a gag initially where they would retell certain scenes from,
yes,
different perspectives? Have they continued that through all four seasons?
They have. And so it's interesting to see, like, so these two dudes, the kind of one who's an author who broke up the other guy's marriage, seems like he's dressed really well in the other guy's version of it because he's this cool imposing figure, but then when you see it from his perspective, he was just wearing normal clothes. But
this is what we need on Twitter. You need to be able to see how things look from somebody else's perspective.
Anyway, the episode concludes, spoilers, with a shocking death that should go down in TV history as totally unexpected, show, a major character death that is, I'm still reeling from.
Catherine, who have you been watching die in a major television show recently?
No major television show deaths. At the recommendation of Peter Suderman, I read Jennifer Egan's Manhattan Beach over my vacation, which is a great World War II era, you cannot describe it without using the word gritty, type book involving a diving squad and a bunch of other stuff. Very, very good. Very delightful. But I also read The Calculating Stars by Mary Robinette Quall, which features another World War II era plot, but this one is an alternate history. And without giving away too much, I will say a meteor wipes out Washington, D.C., and some ladies become astronauts, probably. So it's pretty good. And I think we can all agree that meteor wiping out Washington, D.C. is starting to sound
no great
would
loss. No
be
great
bad
loss.
For the reason office, though.
We got one in
we
L.A.
We are currently taping this just about a mile and a half north of the White House. So at least let's get an early warning system. I have been playing the video game Wolfenstein 2, The New Colossus. It takes place in an alternate history in which the Nazis won. And you play a guy who takes a lot of weapons and machinery and technology and murders Nazis. And it's so great. Thank you all for listening. This has been The Reason Podcast. Please remember to rate and review us on iTunes. Subscribe. Tell your friends, family, and pets to subscribe as well. And with that, may I remind you all, never do a bad tweet. Goodbye.